Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today with us, Chris Larimer, professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa in our Cedar Falls studio. Hi, Chris.
Hello, Ben.
Rachel Caulfield with us in our Des Moines studio, a professor of political science at Drake University. Rachel, welcome to you.
Hi, Ben. Hi, Chris.
It's a July 3rd Politics Wednesday edition.
It's our own little salute to America.
Did you bring your armor?
Not today. My tank is parked outside.
Okay, there's a little preview of what we'll talk about yesterday. In fact, on my screen, Rachel, right now I'm seeing The Hill reporting, military tells D.C. residents don't panic at seeing tanks on the streets. We'll talk about that a little bit later in the program. A bit of a controversy there. We'll also talk about the 2020 campaign, of course. And we want to ask you this hour if you watched the debates that were last week featuring 20 of the Democratic presidential candidates. Did you watch the debate? Did it change your thinking? Join our conversation. 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. Well, let's talk about a few of the other things in political news before we get to 2020 politics. The Department of Homeland Security's independent watchdog said yesterday, crowded, filthy conditions, more widespread at migrant centers, this along our southwestern border, more widespread than initially revealed. Inspectors visited 5 facilities in the Rio Grande Valley in Texas. Last month, they found standing room only cells with children without showers or hot meals, according to this report. And this is by the watchdog, the Office of the Inspector General, an assessment supported by accounts of House Democrats who detailed their own findings this week. 2 House committees announcing hearings to begin about these centers next week. Let's listen to Ayanna Pressley. Ayanna Pressley is a Massachusetts 7th Congressional District Representative addressing a raucous crowd on her plans. This is in Texas on site. Her plans for bringing change to the treatment of migrants at the southern border.
And that keeps families together. I learned a long time ago that when change happens, it's either because people see the light or they feel the fire. Today we are lifting up these stories in the hopes that you will see the light. And if you don't, we will bring the fire.
Rachel Caulfield, the Democrats trying to put pressure on here. What do you see as the political fallout of what we're discovering is can only be described as squalid conditions in some of these migrant centers?
Well, it certainly continues to elevate the issue of immigration among the Democratic contenders. You know, we have seen a massive influx of people on the southern border. And so the people who are being detained, it's estimated that, you know, the numbers have increased just by thousands and thousands of people, and the system is simply overwhelmed at this point. How it gets resolved is unclear. Congress has asked for additional money or is trying to allocate additional money for this. Republicans, of course, attacking Democrats who weren't initially on board with that plan. So we're seeing this become a very nasty partisan fight.
Right. And within the Democratic Party, Democrats fighting amongst themselves over that spending bill passed last week. Liberal Democrats wanting some strict conditions that some also Hispanic members had demanded, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, the question really is it about not having enough money in the system, or is it about how that money is being used? And a number of Democratic lawmakers contended that the real problem was financial mismanagement in the system and changes in bureaucratic policies that hold people at detention centers for longer periods of time. And so they wanted to put some conditions on the allocation of that money. That in turn gave Republicans an opportunity to fight back and say, hey, we're trying to solve this problem. It's Democrats who are holding it up. So it's going to be a bitter partisan battle. It's going to elevate the issue of immigration for the Democratic contenders. But we see in a number of public opinion polls that immigration keeps climbing among the issues that Americans are most concerned about.
Mm-hmm. Anything to add to that account, Chris, or you agree with that picture?
No, I agree with Rachel. I think with this issue of immigration, it really is just sort of an extension of the 2016 presidential campaign, where that was a lot of it was about immigration, but it was framing immigration in terms of kind of this in-group, out-group mentality. And so, you know, the issue has become so polarized in the fact that there is a sense of urgency within Congress, but to some extent there isn't, because we've heard about these squalid conditions for several weeks now, and we're not seeing any sort of improvement. In fact, it seems to be getting worse the more time goes on. And so with immigration being reframed as either, you know, it's no longer about economic opportunity, right? I mean, it seems to be really about for some Americans, the immigrants on the border are people who are part of the out-group, that they're potentially taking away economic opportunity from Americans. For others, they see this group of individuals as being someone who we should be reaching out to, be more compassionate toward. And it's all sort of caught up in politics, and it goes back to the 2016 presidential election.
Mm-hmm.
And when the Inspector General of the Department of Homeland Security says this is a ticking time bomb, it's probably worth taking that seriously.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
Rachel Caulfield with us of Drake University, Chris Larimer of the University of Northern Iowa. Let's talk about, we had a resolution yesterday about the 2020 census. Once every 10 years, we have a mandated census in this country, and a lot rides on the numbers there. The census, upcoming census, won't ask about citizenship. Yesterday, the Trump administration dropped its plan to add a question to next year's this announcement came after a Supreme Court ruling last week that temporarily blocked the effort. Critics and even officials at the Census Bureau said, Chris, that this would mean that it would lead to an undercount of non-citizens and minority residents?
Yeah, that's right. And that was the concern. I mean, there was a part of this was a logistical concern that, you know, they really needed to know by July whether or not this was going to be added to the census that goes out next year, or and they start doing this in April of 2020. But in terms of the politics of this and in terms of representation, you're absolutely right. There was a concern that minority residents, non-citizens would be fearful of responding to this question, be fearful of taking part in the census for fear of, government stepping in, government being deported, essentially. And so that would lead to an underrepresentation. And if you think about where non-citizens or minority residents are most likely to reside, it's in larger urban areas. And so for the Democratic Party, there was a concern that adding this census would actually hurt their representation within the U.S. House of Representatives based on those census numbers.
Mm-hmm. In a 5-4 split, back to that Supreme Court decision, the Chief Justice Roberts joined liberal justices in this case. The explanation offered by the Trump administration, which was that a more accurate count of citizens was needed to enforce the 1965 Voting Rights Act. Now, this was rejected by Roberts and the other justices on that side. They said the question appears to have been contrived, Rachel.
Mm-hmm. This is actually a fascinating Supreme Court decision for a number of different reasons. Justice Roberts basically said, look, you know, of course, the Secretary of Commerce has the right to make this decision. We don't question that. But, you know, we can certainly determine whether or not the justification that is provided for the decision is legitimate or not. And the decision really rests on the fundamental premise that the justification was not legitimate, that it was, in the words of Chief Justice Roberts, contrived. And there are a growing mountain of documents that accompany this case regarding the purposes of the question for the government. Secretary Wilbur Ross had said basically, look, the Department of Justice had asked us to include this question so they could enforce the Voting Rights Act. That's why we did it. But if you go back in correspondence within the Department of Commerce and the Justice Department, Wilbur Ross appears to have made this decision within his very first weeks of entering that position at Commerce. And he, in turn, appears to have reached out to the Justice Department and said, hey, can you write us a memo asking us to do this? And then it turns out that there's a memo from a deceased Republican operative that's in a set of computer files that were unearthed, that where this Republican operative basically lays out a citizenship question as a way to undercount non-citizens in urban areas and people of color in urban areas. That wasn't even submitted in the initial lawsuit.
And the implications, just make sure we're clear on the implications of undercounting minority citizens or undocumented workers.
Yeah. So when that, you know, the idea here is that any undercount would affect not only the apportionment of federal representatives for purposes of the House of Representatives, but also any number of funding programs that the federal government, where they disperse money to states and localities, those are based on census numbers. And so those census numbers are really important in determining a lot of programs. And so when you undercount, then that disadvantages those areas of the country.
Right. And when we talk undercount by including or not including, by including this question, we're not talking about thousands or hundreds of thousands. We're talking about millions
of people
undercounted.
Yes.
So it is a big deal.
Potentially.
Potentially, what, 5% of the census would be thrown one way or the other based on having this question or not. Interesting. So evidently, that has been decided for now after being up in the air for quite a while.
Well, it might not be. We have a new tweet from the president saying,
oh,
no.
Do tell.
The president's been lamenting the fact that the Supreme Court made the decision that it did, and he has brought up a couple times that he really wants to find a way to get this question onto the census anyway. I don't think that's going to happen. But in the meantime now, other federal agencies that do collect this information are saying, hey, we could give you this information. We can share it.
Okay. We'll keep our eyes on it. Let's talk about the Trump's taxes. They are back in the news. The Democratic-led U.S. House of Representatives, a panel on Tuesday, yesterday, filed this has been waited for a long time, a lawsuit in federal court to demand that the president, his individual and business tax returns be turned over. Now, this is the House Ways and Means Committee filing a lawsuit against the U.S. Treasury Department and the Internal Revenue Service. Stephen Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, refused a legal request for the records and defied a couple of congressional subpoenas seeking the return. So let me turn to you, Chris. The Congress says we need this for oversight, and the president's people, his attorneys say, no, you don't.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And this is a battle that has been ongoing really since January of 2017. But as you said, you know, the House Ways and Means, the chairman of the committee there has requested this information again. And when you read the reports about this, you know, he's saying he's going based on the U.S. tax code, which says that the Treasury shall furnish the committee with any requested tax return information. Obviously, the Treasury Secretary, Stephen Mnuchin, is pushing back. The president is pushing back, saying that they do not need this information. This is not a legitimate oversight request. But from members of Congress, this was expected. And this was expected as soon as the Democrats took over control of the U.S. House of Representatives following the 2018 midterm election. We knew this was going to happen. I think this is probably going to continue to be a battle over getting this information. I think what's interesting with this tax information is that some of this battle is sort of getting pushed aside as the closer we get to 2020 and the more that immigration continues to be an issue. this request over tax information seems to be kind of moving off to the side.
Mm. It's Politics Wednesday edition of River to River. Chris Larimer of the University of Northern Iowa, Rachel Caulfield, our other political scientist from Drake University. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. We have an email from Steve in Mason City. What do you make, he writes, of how little has been said by both Trump opponents and supporters about E. Jean Carroll's account of being raped by President Trump? Should we expect more litigation in the court of public opinion? Rachel, what do you have to say about that? That is just over a week ago, and actually the fact that it was relegated to the back pages, not the front pages of many of the mainstream newspapers, became a story in itself.
Yeah, it really did. You know, I think this is one of those situations where when we talk about the normalization of a culture of sexual assault or misogyny, you know, there's no shortage of women who have alleged that President Trump has assaulted them.
I think we're up to 16 at least.
Yeah. And so, you know, to some extent, I think most Americans already know how they feel about this. And a new allegation is not largely going to change the way they feel about the president.
Right.
And that is, you know, it's a statement, I think, on where we are in our political culture. It's a sad statement on where we are as a political culture. But I think it is nonetheless true. I think the timing was also, let's say, inconsistent with the political world timeline, right? I mean, it came out right before these Democratic debates, and there was all this attention given to the Democratic candidates. And so it was pretty quickly pushed off of the front burner for a lot of media outlets.
Mm-hmm. This happened last Friday, an interesting political event from a former president Jimmy Carter, telling a crowd last Friday that a full investigation into the Russia election interference would show Donald Trump did not win the 2016 election, and that he came to the presidency by way of the Russians. Let's listen to a little bit of this conversation. It was recently part of a panel discussion in Virginia. Presidential historian John Meacham, that's the first voice you'll hear. He was the moderator, asking former President Carter about Russian interference in the 2016 presidential election.
Russia has been proven, or by our intelligence community, to have interfered with one of our human rights, which is the right of free and fair elections. Yeah. What's your reaction? How should we deal with Russia?
Well, the president himself should condemn it, admit that it happened, which I think 16 of intelligence agencies have already agreed to say. And there's no doubt that the Russians did interfere in the election. And I think the interference, although not yet quantified, if fully investigated, would show that Trump didn't actually win the election in 2016. He lost the election, and he was put into office because the Russians interfered on his behalf.
So do you believe President Trump is an illegitimate president?
Based on what I just said, which I can't retract.
Okay, President Carter last Friday. President Trump responding to that criticism by calling Jimmy Carter, quote, a nice man, but, quote, a terrible president. Chris, you first. Do you think there might be a time when an investigation reveals, quantifies, in the words of the former president, that Donald Trump did not actually win the 2016 election without help from the Russians?
To quantify that in terms of number of votes is going to be unbelievably difficult, if probably not impossible. I mean, because at that point you're getting down to the extent to which they interfered, the extent to which that actually changed voters' minds in terms of who they voted for or even whether they voted.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't get at that sort of information with the voter file, right? Unless you are actually getting voters and really getting inside their heads, there is really no way to know that. Now, we do know that Russia interfered. We do know that there are concerns that they're going to interfere again in 2020 in terms of digital media and, individual state voter files. But the thing about these elections is that they're all administered by individual states. And so it would be an unbelievably complex process to even start to try to get any sort of even rough estimate of a number of, in terms of how that actually affected the vote mm-hmm. count in 2016. I think, it's fair to say that Russia interfered, but to try to quantify that is unbelievably difficult.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Rachel, what's your view on this? Will we come to any sort of conclusion, quantifiable conclusion about the Russian interference and Donald Trump being president?
No, I agree completely with Chris. This is, in any election, there are forces outside of the campaign. In this case, obviously, Russian government interference. But, in other cases, it might be something that a company does or something that, a celebrity does that changes the narrative of the campaign, changes the way people understand the candidates, the issues. In this case, it was a coordinated campaign by the Russians. But we will never have a good way of being able to quantify the extent to which it affected actual votes by actual voters. And so I just don't think that's a realistic expectation.
Mm-hmm. I mean, one way to think about this is, we as political scientists are starting to come to terms with whether or not yard signs really affect vote counts.
Right.
And that's a really hard study to do. If it's really hard to know the extent to which yard signs affect vote counts, I mean, trying to understand Russian interference in terms of vote counts is just beyond anything we can probably do.
Okay, coming up on a break, let's try to squeeze in a caller. Jeremy in Des Moines is with us. Jeremy, not much time for you, but I'd love to squeeze you in. Make it quick, please. Welcome to the program.
Yeah, I just had a quick comment on the immigration issue. It seems to me like media and congressional Democrats are latching onto the sensationalist angle of substandard conditions, and they're glazing over the root cause, which is the fact that these detention centers are well over capacity with people who shouldn't be trying to cross the border in the first place. Mm-hmm. They have no legitimate claim to asylum. They haven't tried to enter the country illegally, or they haven't tried to enter legally, mm-hmm. and the bottom line is that if they hadn't tried to enter the country illegally in the first place, they wouldn't be in a detention center.
Jeremy, thanks.
And instead of...
Just to give time for a response, Jeremy, I'm going to say thanks for that point and dish it over to Rachel.
There's no question. I think one of the things that on both sides, there are kind of issues of short-sightedness, right, in terms of what are both the root causes of the problem and what are the bigger ramifications of the problem and fixing it. And I think there's oftentimes a lack of understanding about the motives and expectations of the individuals that are involved in immigration. And I mean, these people, they made a choice. Some people see that choice as justified. Some people don't. But they made a choice. And it is incredibly disheartening then to know that once they make that choice, there are very few options in terms of how we deal with that. But they are real people, real lives, real families, and our policies have to change. We're struggling to figure out how.
We'll be back with Rachel and Chris after a short break. Also, we continue our series looking at 2020 presidential candidates with a home state view of former Colorado Governor John Hickenlooper. We'll be joined by Megan Verley, public affairs editor with Colorado Public Radio, when we return. And of course, 2020 politics ahead and that big 4th of July celebration, of course, because it's President Trump, it will be unlike previous celebrations. We'll find out the controversy around that when we come back. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th. With 6 race events, including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Political scientists Rachel Caulfield of Drake University, Chris Larimer of the University of Northern Iowa on board. We'll have more analysis from Rachel and Chris in just a few minutes, but now we continue with our home state View series. It's a series in which we focus on the individual Democratic presidential candidates by talking with someone in the media from their home state who's been covering them for some time. Well, let's get a home state view of businessman, former governor of Colorado, and now 2020 Democratic presidential candidate John Hickenlooper. Joining us to do that, Megan Verley. She's public affairs editor with Colorado Public Radio. Before that, She covered State House and state politics for 8 years before becoming editor. Megan, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Take us back to some of the days we wouldn't remember here in Iowa. How did Hickenlooper make a name for himself, and on what issues?
Well, he first made his name in Colorado, and in Denver in particular, by opening a brewery in an incredibly blighted neighborhood, a neighborhood that is now very vital. It's sort of the centerpiece of downtown, but he pioneered the revitalization of that part of town. After that, he ran for mayor, presided as mayor over the coming of the Democratic National Convention, which was a real moment in the national spotlight for Denver, and then became governor in the depths of the recession and presided, as he likes to tell people on the presidential campaign trail, over Colorado's resurgence and its recent boom.
Mm-hmm. So as governor of Colorado, what issues was he known for?
I would say that overall, and underlying everything, he was known as a booster of Colorado. He liked to bring companies here. He liked to announce that companies were coming here. And so he did have this sort of relentless economic boosting going on. In terms of political issues, he was known for presiding over a session in 2013 that saw a bunch of gun control measures passed. This came after the shooting at the Aurora movie theater, and also, and actually more crucially, after the Sandy Hook massacre. It was a very, very controversial package. It was hugely divisive to the state. It led to some recalls of state lawmakers. And Hickenlooper really showed his style through that by working very hard behind the scenes and saying very little definitively in public.
Mm-hmm. Does he work well across the aisle?
He wants to. I would say that issues like that, he found that he could not work across the aisle, although Republicans in the chamber at the time do say that he at least was talking to them, which is not always the case. He wants to bring various sides together. He's gotten a lot of criticism from the left in this state for being very willing to work with the oil and gas industry around trying to get incrementally further on regulations and controls as a way to check some of the more anti-development impulses among the concerned environmental groups in the state.
Mm-hmm. When Hickenlooper has been criticized as governor back during those two terms, how has he reacted?
To go back to the gun control example, that's probably the first time that he faced very severe public backlash. He'd had a good popularity rating until then. He really was trying to get the state out of the recession and doing stuff that people liked around that. But gun control is a hugely divisive issue. It brought protesters out. It was the first time he saw his popularity rankings go down. And he stumbled on that, to be honest. Shortly after signing the bills, he was at a gathering of county sheriffs who were very opposed to those measures. And he said, got caught on tape saying that, hey, if I had known how deep the opposition to this was, maybe we wouldn't have signed it, but we promised, said that we would, we'd promised. Mm. And he just got raked over the coals for that.
Mm. Interesting. Tell us about the team that Hickenlooper had as governor and the type of people he likes to surround himself with.
Well, I think one thing that's notable is that in his cabinet as governor, he did always have a couple of Republicans, moderate Republicans, people who were used to working across the aisle, but he was very careful not to just have a Democratic council. He really very notably, when it came time after the last census to redistrict Colorado's state-level districts, there was an 11-person commission. He had the power to make it majority Democratic, and instead he appointed an independent to lead it and to balance out the two parties. So I think he is somebody who has brought in folks who maybe don't strongly oppose his views, but will challenge him on certain points. And I think it's notable that people in his cabinet stayed on for fairly significant lengths of time. There wasn't a ton of turnover when he was governor.
Mm-hmm. Megan, as someone who's covered John Hickenlooper for years when you were covering the State House and state politics there in Colorado, what would you say is the essence of his sort of personal appeal, how he is seen by voters in his home state, more as a on a personal basis?
Well, I think you see it on the national campaign trail as well, that he has this very sort of aw shucks demeanor. that he has a lot of malpropisms. He's getting better at that, but some of them in his early days were pretty legendary around here. He once accidentally referred to his lieutenant governor as a sex star when he meant to call him a rock star.
Ooh.
Colorado is a pretty easygoing state, though. People pretty much just laugh that off as like, wow, I can't believe our governor said that, but didn't. It wasn't a big deal. So I think that kind of he's willing to have a foot in his mouth. He doesn't get ruffled by sort of stumbling a little bit. And I think that's an appeal that he's trying to take out on the national campaign trail to say, hey, you know, I'm a smart, capable guy who gets stuff done, but I'm also really unassuming. He wants to be kind of still that bartender in a way.
Mm-hmm. So when you see him in the national spotlight, that is the same John Hickenlooper you covered in Colorado.
He's gotten more polished and he's gotten a lot more comfortable in a position of opposition. You know, to watch him go after Bernie Sanders and the move in the party to be more comfortable with the term socialism, that I think surprised us a little bit in Colorado. You know, he never, as governor, got up there and bashed Republicans gratuitously. You know, he would get into the partisan fights, but he wasn't trying to score those kinds of political points. He wanted to be seen as somebody who was almost nonpartisan, which is not really possible to do at this level of politics. And so I think it is a shift for him to set his sights on something that his party is doing and to so vocally go after it.
Mm-hmm. Megan, and in closing, with John Hickenlooper in the national spotlight now, a lot of coverage. I wonder if you can tell us, perhaps share a little known fact that we probably don't know about John Hickenlooper.
You know, I think two things come to mind. One is that at least in Colorado, he was famous for wacky campaign commercials. He famously would not go negative. So in one of them, he jumped out of an airplane. In another that I remember, he got into a shower fully clothed to talk about how icky the negative campaigning was. So he was very much known for that. And I think if he gets to the point of running national TV commercials, we'll be curious to see if he keeps that style. And then the other is that he has a dog named Skyler Colfax, which is named for the same general who one of our very long avenues in Denver is named after. And it was, if I remember correctly, I believe actually trained in a prison program that where prisoners train dogs to be good pets. So Sky the dog was a permanent fixture around the Capitol when he was governor.
Megan Verlee, thank you very much. Public Affairs Editor, Colorado Public Radio, with a look at John Hickenlooper, a 2020 Democratic presidential candidate with a lot of background that we didn't know about. At least I didn't know. Megan, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, back with Rachel Caulfield of Drake University and Richard, where did I get that? Chris Larimer.
That's my dad's name. So.
Okay, I was channeling something, I guess.
Been renamed.
Chris from the University of Northern Iowa here, thanks to Richard in part.
Yeah, there you go.
Let's talk about John Hickenlooper there. We heard a bit of background there from Colorado. But when we look at some political news on John Hickenlooper from last week, we see that at least five of his staffers are left, are reported leaving, in the process of leaving, that his operation is struggling. Hickenlooper blaming former staff for his failure to gain traction in the crowded Democratic primary. So here we are, and yet I look at the Des Moines Register candidate tracker. John Hickenlooper here this weekend, the 4th of July weekend. Comment on Hickenlooper or how hard it is to break out of the pack of 20-something here, Chris.
Well, you know, listening to Megan's description of Hickenlooper, I mean, when he first declared, he was one of the more interesting candidates because of his background, because of his kind of interesting personality. He had always come off as very relatable, as she said, in Colorado. And I think that was something, at least I was watching to see if that would allow him to gain some traction in Iowa, that he seemed to be pretty comfortable around voters. He was okay kind of doing goofy things and trying to relate to voters on a personal level. And so Iowa is kind of a great state for him, theoretically. The problem with Hickenlooper is that with all these names in the field now, with a Biden, Sanders, and then you have Harris and Warren making movement, you know, Pete Buttigieg starting to move up in the polls, he's just sort of getting lost in the pack. And I think that's that's what's difficult for him. I think initially, if the field had remained relatively small, Iowa may have given him a chance. But I think now at this point, he's just been overtaken by 5, 6, 7, 8+ candidates.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about the debate that happened last week. According to a Politico Morning Consult poll of voters, I'm sure there have been other polls, but this one says that Kamala Harris and Elizabeth Warren earned the highest marks among voters who watched last week's Democratic presidential primary debates. More voters gave Harris and Warren excellent marks than any of the other candidates. The poll shows more than one in four debate watchers. 27% said Harris did an excellent job. 23% said Warren did an excellent job. The former vice president and Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders both rated as excellent by 16. Comment on this, Rachel, about the debate analysis and what you took away from the movement we've seen since those debate performances.
Well, so the debate performances themselves, this is just such an interesting kind of new way that we have seen debates with so many candidates in the field in 2016 and now in 2020. We have different parties, very different visions. But this idea that you have to kind of break out early on a debate stage in order to be recognized as a viable candidate, I think this is a new feature of campaigns, and I'll be curious to see how it develops going forward. For anyone who watched the debate, I mean, I think they were fascinating nights of conversation among the candidates. What we've seen since the debate is we have seen pretty, across all polls, consistent decline in support for Joe Biden. And we've seen Kamala Harris has gained support in virtually every poll. I think one poll has her relatively flat within the margin of error, but most of the polls show a pretty significant bump for her. I think going into the debate, one of the big questions was, would she try to have a breakout moment by prosecuting the case against Joe Biden, right? Because that's her background. And I don't think she did it as a prosecutor. You saw some of those prosecutorial skills in her ability to weave a story and ask questions. But what you saw was you saw Kamala Harris as a person questioning the judgment of Joe Biden. And I thought that was probably, and other people have said, right, that was the best moment of any candidate on the stage last week. So it's not surprising to me that we see her increasing. The commentary following the debate, one of the things that I found most interesting was the lack of attention on Bernie Sanders. Virtually nobody was talking about Bernie Sanders, which I find really interesting.
Here's a comment from William in Cedar Rapids, then we'll get Chris's thoughts. William, one of our listeners in Cedar Rapids, writes, "I am very concerned that journalists and debate moderators will influence and shape the campaign issues by asking the wrong questions or not addressing certain issues at all." He continues, "For example, during the second round of the recent Democratic candidate debates, the first question addressed to Bernie Sanders was, will you be raising taxes on middle-class families to finance your national health care system? The better question to ask, according to William of Cedar Rapids, do you think middle-class families would be willing to pay more in income tax if the net savings to their annual family budget would be thousands of dollars more with a Medicare for all health system?" Chris, react to that or give us some thoughts on what you came to mind for you after those debates.
Well, I think maybe at a more general level to comment on what William was pointing out there, we do know from research that, when you look at the primary debates and public response to them, the media narrative has a big impact on that. And voters tend to take their cues from the media narrative surrounding the debates, the post-debate analysis, and then we're into the process of hearing about all these polls that are coming out after the debate, and the polls are all about, that Kamala Harris is surging, Elizabeth Warren is surging, that Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders struggled, and they're struggling in the polls. I think, what we also have to keep in mind, obviously, is that this is still very, very early. Because there are so many candidates, there's probably going to be quite a bit of fluidity in the race as we move forward. What's interesting for the Democrats is that when you think about the last three cycles, whether it's 2016, 2008, or 2000, there were relatively few candidates, right? In 2000, it was just Al Gore and Bill Bradley. In 2008, it really came down to a three-person race with Edwards, Clinton, and Obama. And then in 2016, it was Clinton and Sanders. Now we're talking about 24 candidates, really, and I think that that's something new for Democratic voters or potential Democratic caucus goers or primary goers, and so they have to keep that in mind. The other thing with these polls is that yes, Harris and Warren are surging, but there are, in most of these polls, there's usually a question about who do you think has the best chance to beat Donald Trump, and generally Joe Biden performs the best of all the candidates. They see him as most capable of defeating Donald Trump, that most Democratic voters see that as the number one goal. And so I don't know that it's necessarily all bad news for Joe Biden at this point. I do think he, you know, it's clear that he struggled in that first debate, as did Bernie Sanders. But I think, you know, if voters are still looking long term and just thinking about winning in 2020, in November of 2020, then I think that's where, you know, Biden still has the edge. But again, this is all very early.
Good Lord, we got to do this for another 6 months.
Right.
I mean, you know, this is,
we haven't even got to the Iowa caucuses,
by
the
way.
Before we talk about the 4th of July celebration tomorrow, I want to get to a question. We won't have time to have the caller on the air, but Troy in Iowa City asking about the candidates being on our local IPR stations. Yes, Troy, we planned to start reaching out to campaigns around the state fair to get them to sit down and talk with us on River to River here. Also, Clay Masters, Kate Payne, will be reaching out to them for caucus land. And we've been coordinating with NPR in a series of interviews with the candidates and have aired excerpts of those interviews on Morning Edition, All Things Considered, just to answer that. Of course, journalism is more complicated when you have more than 20 candidates, just as we pointed out last time.
Everything's more complicated.
Everything's more complicated. Let's talk about the 4th of July, which was more simple than it appears to be this year. Yesterday, battle tanks were seen on a train in Washington ahead of tomorrow's 4th celebration, highlighting the U.S. military, the military's might for President Trump's Salute to America 4th of July celebration. Let's listen to the president yesterday in the Oval Office, who was asked about the upcoming 4th of July celebration to be held in our nation's capital.
We're going to have a great 4th of July in Washington, D.C. It'll be like no other. It'll be special. And I hope a lot of people come, and it's going to be about this country, and it's a salute to America. And I'm going to be here, and I'm going to say a few words, and we're going to have planes going overhead, the best fighter jets in the world, and other planes, too. And we're going to have some tanks stationed outside.
Okay. Rachel, help us understand the criticism there, because there is a fair bit of it. Why shouldn't the president, a sitting president, shape the 4th of July celebration the way he wants to in this case?
Well, critics would say a couple things about what's happening tomorrow in this salute to America. First, they have made the argument that the 4th of July celebration on the National Mall has traditionally been a nonpartisan affair, and that President Trump has a history of using nonpartisan events as the equivalent of campaign rallies. We know that the White House has given out some tickets to GOP donors and political appointees. And so they will have a separate viewing area for the president's speech and the fireworks. And it seems far more partisan than what we've seen in the past. Second, I've heard some former military generals who have offered a critique, which is basically that this is not a day to showcase the military. This is about American independence, not American military might. And we know that this idea appears to have come to President Trump during the Bastille Day parade in 2017 that he witnessed in France. And so there seems to be some tie in there that he likes the idea of celebrating the military. The 4th of July, I think some people would argue the 4th of July just isn't the place to do it. Mm-hmm. That this isn't about the military per se, that we have other days and other ceremonies that specifically focus on military service and veterans. And I think there are other people who I have two more critiques real quick. I think there are other people who see this as reminiscent of nationalism, the kind of parades that happen in countries that are heavily nationalistic. And that's concerning to them. And then there's the cost. So National Park Service has estimated that, well, they've already, I think, Transition $2.5 million worth of fees into this endeavor.
National Park Service. Yeah.
It's a very expensive endeavor.
Mm. Chris, the final word from you on this 4th of July celebration tomorrow.
Well, I mean, I'm still struggling to wrap my head around what exactly we're going to see tomorrow. I mean, you know, the more you hear the president talk about this, the more you get the sense that, you know, at some point his face is going to show up in one of the fireworks toward the end of the show.
Yes, I mean, with the American flag.
Right.
That, you know, will be in the fireworks.
Did you see that's going to happen? That's not in jest.
No, they're going to make an American flag out of fireworks.
I thought it was Donald Trump's face.
No, I don't believe that's going to happen.
Okay. But I think what Rachel is saying, you know, that it's going from a nonpartisan to a partisan event, mm-hmm. and particularly on that nationalism element to it. I mean, that's something, you know, we've heard since the 2016 election. We've heard for the last 2 years about the role of nationalism in the United States and the surge in nationalism around the world. Is this part of that process?
We'll have to leave it there and wait in less than 24 hours. Of course, we'll have the 4th of July, and we'll know what's happening in D.C. then. Thank you very much, Chris Larimer, professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa. Rachel Caulfield, professor of political science at Drake University. Rachel and Chris, what a great team. Thanks for being on the show today.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Happy 4th of July to everyone. River to River is produced by Rick Brewer and Caitlin Harrop. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Help today from Camus Leeson. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Have a happy 4th.